The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
The new ESRI report published today has shown and forecasted that up to 15,500 more staff will be needed to be hired to work within the country's public acute hospitals to cope with the growing population. The report by the Economic and Social Research Group utilised census data to estimate where population growths will happen and indicates where the biggest vulnerabilities and staffing shortages lie within the health service, with recruitment needed both nationally and regionally in all counties. I'm joined now by Dr. Conor Keegan, Senior Research Officer with the ESRI, to tell us about all of this, and also by Professor John Crown, a Consultant Medical Oncologist at St. Vincent's Hospital Group. Good morning and welcome to you both. Conor, we'll start with the nuts and bolts of this report. What was your methodology exactly? Because if you look at current staffing levels as your template, you'd be far short.
Sure. So good morning, Pat. So in this report, we project public hospital workforce requirements out to 2035, both nationally and regionally. And these projections examine the potential impact of a range of factors that might affect hospital workforce requirements into the future. So particularly things like population change, so population growth and ageing, but also factors related to slouch care implementation. So including the establishment of these regional health areas. So these are the new geographic regions which will align hospital and community services, and we examine kind of how projected workforce requirements might differ along that regional dimension. So in terms of findings, I guess, first of all, we're projecting that public hospital workforce requirements will increase for all the staff categories examined. So we examined four main patient-facing staff categories, so medical, nursing and midwifery, healthcare assistants, and health and social care professionals. So across all these groups, as you said, we're projecting an increase in staff requirements of between 12,000 and kind of up to 15,500 by 2035. Or if you think of that in terms of percentage terms, it's about kind of 1.7 to 2.1% growth per year on average in terms of staff requirements.
Now, again, back to my basic question, are you basing those increases and those requirements on current staffing levels? Because everyone's experience is that the staffing levels are not adequate now. So if you're using that as your base template, it means that you know, when these figures and aging population and demographics come to pass, there still won't be enough staff.
Sure. So our base year for this analysis is 2019, and we primarily use HSE administrative data on the number of workers employed in the hospital system, so it's kind of HSE census data. Now, I guess the problem with that is it doesn't capture things like the additional contribution of overtime and agency to delivering care in our base year. So we did an awful lot of work engaged with the HSE and with organizations like the National Doctors Training and Planning Unit to actually look at, well, actually, in addition to kind of the base requirements or the base delivery of staff in 2019, what's the additional requirements in terms of the overtime that's delivered in terms of care, and also the contribution of agency? So we do inflate our base our base year.
What do you go for what workforce would be termed whole time equivalents? You know, bearing in mind the agency staff and the fact that people have to work far more hours than possibly is even safe.
Yeah, exactly. So we are trying to match the supply of care in terms of workforce with the demand for care in a base year as close as we can, and using that then as a basis for projecting workforce requirements into the future.
Now, the problem with that is that it seems to be, even with all the agency staff and the overtime, it seems to be a scramble to deliver the service. So did you add on a buffer? You know, we're told that our hospitals should be 80% full all the time, not 102% full all the time with the trolleys. So if you go back to that kind of service, the service that a civilized society would require, you'd have to add another, you know, for comfort, another 15-20%. Did you do that?
I guess one thing, that's a very good question, Pat. So one thing that wasn't possible to do in the analysis is to look at what we call best practice staffing. So we put an awful lot of effort, again, engage with the HSE to kind of consider, well, actually, if you wanted to kind of run a health service, you know, as I guess you'd want to, you'd actually want to have these kind of ratios in place in terms of, you know, underlying supply of staff to demand. Now, unfortunately, it wasn't possible to get at those ratios for this analysis, but there is work ongoing with the HSE, and we're going to hope to kind of, I guess, extend this analysis into the future, where we can look at, well, actually, what is best staffing in terms of medical? What is best staffing in terms of nursing? And if we were to, as you say, introduce a buffer like that, well, what effect might it have on the projections?
Yeah.
I guess another important point, though, in terms of when we're considering these projections, is we project on a range. So actually, we've kind of a what we call a high pressure, a central, and a low pressure range. So, you know, within that range, you're capturing kind of, I guess, you know,
the buffer is
the buffer.
Yeah.
As you kind of.
So you know, so when you're talking about maybe between 12,500 and 15,500, the 15,500 would give you your buffer. You would hope.
You would hope, yes. So, yeah. I mean, that's why, you know, there's always uncertainty involved with these projections, you know, modelling into the future. So that's why we always kind of consider a range. So you'd hope, you know, kind of that 15,500 very much is kind of at the top end of the range, what that would be needed for these staff categories.
Now, when is that figure to be reached? What year would the 15,500 net extra, because it is an extra, a net extra, people leave, people retire, people step out to have families and so on. So by what year are we requiring the net extra of 15,500?
So we project, so that this report projects out to 2035. So what we're saying is by 2035 we will need up to an additional 15,500. Now obviously that number of additional will be conditional on how far out you're projecting. So if we project out to kind of 2040, we'd need even more. So it's always better, I think, to think of these projections in terms of percentage terms and in terms of annual average growth. So as I kind of mentioned earlier, in percentage terms, we're talking about a growth rate of about 1.7 to 2.1% per year on average out to 2035.
Okay. Looking at, say, the medical staff you're talking about, 3,236 medical staff, if you divide that by 13 just to bring us up to 2035, 13 years hence, you're talking about an extra 250 doctors in the system. You're looking at maybe 600 extra nurses every year in the system. You're looking at what, again, just doing the math quickly, maybe 270 extra healthcare assistants every year. 166 more dietitians, divide that by 13. You're looking for 13 of those every year, and so on. I can go through the numbers. Where are they all going to come from?
Yeah, so I guess that's a big implication of the report. So, you know, we're projecting large demand in terms of need for these particular professionals. And I guess the big question then is, well, how do you match that demand in terms of supply? So this report didn't consider the supply side. So this is purely a demand-based report where we're looking in terms of our kind of our drivers, in terms of demographics and so forth, what will be needed in terms of workforce requirements into the future.
However, there is
a significant amount of work ongoing within the HSE, within the department, that are currently considering that problem around supply.
And on the supply
side. We've
been
engaged with them on this work as it progressed. So we're hoping, you know, publication of this report in terms of what will be needed will go a long way to informing that kind of supply side work.
Indeed. I mean, a net 40 physiotherapists every year, a net maybe 10, 11 speech and language therapists, a net 12 or 13 social workers every year to be added to. So you got to start now if you're going to meet these targets. But as you say, you're looking at the demand and not the supply side. But very useful work, Conor. And thank you very much for joining us. Dr. Conor Keegan, Senior Research Officer with the ESRI. Now, listening to our conversation is Professor John Crown, who's Consultant Medical Oncologist at St. Vincent's Hospital Group. John, good morning.
Good morning to you, Pat, and good morning to your listeners.
Now, you heard my conversation with Conor, and it's about, you know, if we were starting, should we be starting from here? And even if you take the most generous figures that Conor has included there, allowing for a buffer of some kind, where are all these people going to come from?
Well, Pat, I mean, I think, first of all, I'd like to congratulate Dr. Keegan on the work. It's obviously very exhaustive and, you know, well-researched, and he has identified a future problem. But the problem is it's insufficiently paying attention to the fact that the problem isn't some, you know, hypothetical post-apocalyptic doomsday scenario. It's right now, and it's been going on for years. I'm now in my 30th year since I came back to Ireland, and it hasn't been 1 minute of that time, and I haven't been beaten to the drum about shortages of doctors, specialists, GPs, physios, radiographers, all of the support staff and professionals levels that we need. And it's, you know, the problem is an ongoing one. And saying, you know, aphoristically, well, we have to make sure we have enough people in the future, and then depending on the same people who've allowed the problem to fester for 30 years, and I won't say the same people, but the same institutions, the same structures, and the same healthcare financing model, clearly, I think, is the victory of optimism over experience. I think, you know, this is more than ever telling us that we need fundamental reform of our health system, something which I just don't see on the horizon anymore. It was something which was, you know, promised two elections ago, and it seems to have dropped off the radar screen altogether.
Now there is cross-party agreement, as you know, on the Sláinte Care model, but that doesn't mean that as you try to implement elements of that model that you'll get political agreement. I mean, we saw what happened in Navan Hospital. The chief medical officer there, Dr. McEntee, saying, yeah, it's the right thing to do. This should be a minor injuries kind of place, and everyone who's acutely ill has to go to another hospital. But the politicians then intervene and say, hang on a second.
Well, I guess, I'm, you know, Pat, I'm getting older and crankier, so I'd make two replies to that. Reply, people would say, even crankier. Reply number one is, all the Irish politicians agree on something, what could go wrong? And point number two is, well, you know, there actually is no reform in Sláinte Care. Sláinte Care basically says we can fix all the problems of the current public health system by removing a tiny handful of private patients from that system, enshrining two-tier care with a separate set of private hospitals which public patients can't access, and public hospitals which will be run by the same people who have run them, you know, I would have to say not spectacularly now for all the years that I've been there. The reform I believe that we should do is to bring in true single-tier healthcare, which is based on a social insurance model, something which, you know, not some kind of fantasy left-wing craziness, something which exists right now in Canada, something which exists in Germany, and to be honest with you, Pat, from the hospital point of view, something which already exists for about 30 to 40% of the Irish population. And it's called VHI. VHI isn't particularly private insurance. VHI is owned by the government. The sole share is owned by the Minister for Health. It's community rated. And, you know, they can't pay off their dividends back to shareholders. The money gets plowed back into the system. And a little bit of the tweaking of that system, expansion of that system, would give us something very similar to the excellent health systems which currently exist in Germany, several other northern European countries, and Canada. But people are just, for some reason, too hidebound into thinking about continuation of the HSE/British NHS model. And remember, we could be having this discussion right now in the NHS. All of the headlines in Britain this week are about the colossal staff shortages which the NHS is facing. You know, what a coincidence that the two systems which are funded in exactly the same way and modelled on one another, well, we model ours on theirs, are failing so badly.
So a staff shortage means either that we're not training enough people, or we're training enough people and they're unwilling to work in the Irish health system, so they go elsewhere. They may stay in this country and work for a pharma company or do something else entirely, or they go and work in their chosen profession in a different jurisdiction. So what needs to change?
Well, historically, there is another reason for that, which is they didn't make enough jobs. I mean, I wrote about this in the paper probably about 10 years ago, in which I'd been talking to a patient of mine whose daughter had just graduated with honors from physiotherapy, and there was no job for her, and she was working in Topshop. And, you know, I was just making the point that, you know, perhaps if we redeployed some of the HSE management staff to working at a top shop and freed up the jobs instead to hire physiotherapists, we wouldn't have such, you know, colossal crushing waiting lists for physiotherapy. Now, to an extent, the dynamics of that problem has changed. And there's no doubt that even in situations now where there has been an expansion and where jobs are available, it is harder to fill them. So we need, well, there are a couple of solutions. I believe, again, at the core of it is the lack of nimbleness, the lack of responsiveness of the current bureaucratic structures which run the public health system. I think it just makes it very difficult to act in time to change things, to introduce a degree of what I would call social market forces into the equation as well, and an acknowledgement that, you know, if there are trained people for a job, people won't take the jobs and they're going someplace else, that, you know, except if we're, you know, really looking for an extraordinary level of altruism in people, that we need to pay them more to take the jobs and make the jobs more attractive. But it's not just pay. I mean, I hear it all the time from young doctors in this country who say that the working conditions are just so miserable that they feel that they're practicing a level of medicine which is far inferior to what, you know, very intelligent young women and men with, you know, generally very good training. And now with access to the internet and having done electives in leading centres abroad, understand that they say, this is just not a good place to work right now. I can tell you it's, you know, I was talking to a colleague recently and making the point that I'd spent a good chunk of my working day in the university hospital apologizing to people for delays in scans and trying to explain to them that I really was very upset that it was going to take them 3 months to get a scan or so long to get such a consultation. This is the way all over the health system. We still have multi-year waiting lists for people going to see various specialists in this country. And this is not a new problem, and it's not a problem in, you know, 2029 or 2035 when the population booms. It's right now, and it's ongoing. And, you know, you have to look at the consistent thread which runs through the continuity of this problem, which is that the management system, the funding system, the model is wrong.
Now, John, a couple of things. I'd make a point that came across a doctor recently who is working in the private area and says he you know, would love to work in the public area, but he knows he could not deliver the kind of quality of service that he wants to practice his medicine in the public service at the moment. Just could not do it and could not therefore be at ease with himself that he's going to be able to do the job that he wants to do properly. That's number one. Number two, when my daughter ended up in A&E in Vincent's a couple of weeks back, having been knocked unconscious when she fell, the lack of empathy was quite extraordinary.
Well, I'm very, very sorry to hear that. I do wish your daughter very well.
Now we had a discussion about it, and Chris Luke, who's, as you know, a consultant in emergency medicine, said that is a big problem, burnout, that people get the empathy burned out of them.
Yeah, compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
Is the great ongoing danger, you know? I mean, I turned 65 this year myself, and I'm at the moment I'm exercising some accumulated days off from the public system. But I, as you know, Pat, I've been quite an advocate for reform of the public system for years, and in my heart, I still am. But the practicalities are, I've kind of given up. I just don't see any real prospect that the system will be reformed. There was, at the time of the 2011 election, an absolutely parallel new revolutionary model put forward by Fine Gael and by Labour. It was a model of single tier, single access, based on social insurance, for some reason they used to call it the Dutch model, but it was actually the German model, the Deutsche model, quite similar to what the Canadians had. And it was rapidly abandoned in the face of objections from the Department of Finance, who I think just didn't understand that this actually would have been something which would have aided the public finances, improved, incentivized efficiency in the health system, eliminated lots of waste, and, you know, linked activity, reimbursement, and efficiency in a way that would have guaranteed a higher level of equity. But it's sad. It didn't happen. And I was personally very disappointed. I ran for the Senate at the time thinking that perhaps I'd be in the chamber, I'd be able to help advise on this, and we'd see the reform/revolution come through. But then they dumped it and came out with Schlantecare, which is nothing. Schlantecare is the emperor's new clothes. I mean, it reminds me of the old aphorism from the middle of the 20th century about the big lie. If you tell people a lie often enough, they'll believe it. I mean, Schlantecare is the most two-tier healthcare imaginable. It is far more two-tier than what we have now. Schlantecare is not going to close private healthcare. It's going to, in fact, make it very attractive. All it is doing is taking a handful of public patients out of the private system and pretending it's a healthcare reform.
Or the other way around, yeah. The question, John, and one of the listeners, his name is Mark, says, the Fiscal Advisory Council and the OECD report that the Irish public health system is one of the best funded in the world. Unions and management will not reform the system to deliver good service. It's so frustrating. And the way they work it out is obviously what the Exchequer puts towards healthcare and what people put towards healthcare out of their own pockets, either through VHI or direct payments for services they buy. And when you add up all the sums, there's loads of money there to deliver a good service.
Oh, I agree with him completely. The system is not underfunded. The system is malfunded. I mean, this is the cliche I think I invented about 15 years ago. The system is funded in a way that does not incentivize equity, or efficiency. There's all kinds of perverse incentives in the system. To give you an example, I mean, it takes us so long to get some tests done as an outpatient that we find ourselves through clenched teeth delaying the discharge of patients in hospital beds so that they can get the scan done quicker as an inpatient, even though that means that bed is being blocked for somebody else coming through. And the cost of the person being in the bed is much higher than the cost of having them outside the hospital. I mean, if we, you know, correctly financed in a correct fashion the outpatient and ambulatory services, we'd free up so many beds. But the system incentivizes inefficiency. And, you know, having machines that aren't running 16 hours a day or running 8 hours a day is wrong. Having, you know, oncology services that can't, you know, deliver treatments at nighttime. And again, this is not because the staff are lazy. But, I mean, there's a colossal shortage of pharmacists. There are only, you know, so many chemotherapy or cancer treatments in a day that a pharmacist can safely mix. And, you know, we all understand that there are only so many in a day that an oncology nurse can safely administer. And, you know, a little bit of correct reapportioning of resources rather than just increasing resources, I think, would go a long way.
John, thank you very much for joining us. Professor John Crown, consultant medical oncologist at St. Vincent's Hospital Group. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.